they like to have the solute concentration the same on either side of the plasma membrane. And so what happens is the living organism typically tries to set up an isotonic situation. Now, just let me give you an example of how osmosis might work. It's kind of a little bit of an exaggerated example. But let's say we have our digestive system here. Here's our digestive tract, and we have these cells that line the digestive tract. Okay. Now let's say that we all decide to go down to McDonald's, and we get us a large fry, okay, and all of us like to have lots of salt on our fries. Okay, so we take our large fry with lots of salt on it, and we swallow that French fry here, okay, we didn't chew it up very well, but it has lots of salt on it. What type of a situation is that going to set up for the cells in the digestive tract? In other words, these cells right here. Which way is the water going to move? Okay, it's going to move into the digestive tract or out of the cells. So the water's moving out of the cells. So what type of a situation is that? Hypertonic or hypotonic? Hypertonic. Remember, hyper kids like to go outside and play. Okay, and so it's a hypertonic situation, and our brain picks up that all the water leaving the cells, it receives information from the cells, and our brain says, you idiot, you're going to kill yourself because all of your cells are going to dry out or desiccate, okay? And so then what your brain does is it makes you feel what? Thirsty, okay? So then what we do is we go, we've already left McDonald's, so we'll go down to Maverick and we buy like a 64 ounce Pepsi, all right? And we start guzzling that 64-ounce Pepsi. So now we have all this water along with the Pepsi in our digestive tract. So now what type of a situation does that cause? Hypotonic. Okay. So the solute concentration is higher now inside of the cells, so the water is going to move from our digestive tract into the cells around the digestive tract. Now if we keep drinking that 64-ounce Pepsi, what's going to happen to those cells? They're going to get lots and lots of water in it, and so the brain tells our body, this idiot is trying to kill me again. And so what it does is it takes a lot of the water, our body has a way of dealing with that, it takes the water and puts it into your bladder, and then you need to urinate, right? Okay, drink the whole 64-ounce Pepsi. Okay. So that's just an example of how hypotonic, hypertonic situations work in our body. Okay, just kind of an exaggerated example, but hopefully you understand the principles. Right? Any questions about that? Okay. The last way, well actually there's two more ways that we can move substances across the plasma membrane. One is by what we call active transport. Okay, active transport is when energy is used to move something across the plasma membrane. And actually, this is what we use most of our energy in our body for, is to move substances against their concentration gradients across the plasma membrane. Okay. Now, the way that our neurons, which are our nerves, and our muscle cells work are very, very similar. Basically, we have a plasma membrane here, and really what is important when we're talking about muscle cells and nerve cells are two ions. Potassium ions and sodium ions. Okay, so we have potassium ions. Let's say we have three potassium ions inside of our cell and three potassium ions outside of our cell. We also have three sodium ions, or actually let's make four sodium ions, outside of our cell, and we have four sodium ions inside of our cell. Okay, everybody okay with that? So that's basically everything's diffused. There's no diffusion that can occur. And besides that, potassium and sodium cannot diffuse across the plasma membrane without a gated protein channel. What we have in our muscle cells and our neurons is a little protein. It's called the sodium-potassium pump. and it sits here inside of the plasma membrane. And what happens is this particular sodium potassium pump actually has affinity for sodium on this side for 3 sodium ions and affinity for potassium on this side, and it only has affinity for 2 potassium ions. Okay? And so what happens is 3 sodium ions bond to this protein on this side, 2 potassium ions bond to the protein on this side. Everybody okay with that? Now what happens is an ATP is used. Remember we talked about ATP? It was the energy that is used in cells. And ATP is converted into, well, it's actually, let's just say it's used for right now. And what happens is this protein pump flips, okay? And when it flips, it releases those ions, all right? So essentially what happens is we take 3 of these sodium ions and we put them on the outside of the plasma membrane, and 2 potassium ions, and they go to the inside of the plasma membrane, okay? Now both sodium and potassium are slightly positively charged. And so what this does is it sets up what we call an electrochemical gradient across the semipermeable membrane, okay? All right, electrochemical gradient, that's a big long word, okay? So in other words, if you count up the number of positive ions we have outside of the membrane here, there's one more. So it's actually positively charged out there and negatively charged in here. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And so active transport, what have we done? We're moving substances against their concentration gradient. Now what does sodium want to do at this point? It wants to diffuse back across the plasma membrane, right? Same thing with potassium. Potassium wants to diffuse across the plasma membrane this way. Now the way that your muscles and your neurons work is when we decide to, for example, contract our muscle, there's a little gated protein channel here that is only good for sodium ions. Okay? And then we have another one over here that is only good for potassium ions. And they're both closed. Right? So when, for example, I want to contract my muscle, what happens is this gated protein channel opens up, and how many of these sodium ions are going to diffuse across the plasma membrane?
3.
3, right? Okay. So let's take those 3, diffuse them across. Okay, erase them. Now, can any other sodium diffuse across that plasma membrane? It can't. Now we have equal numbers of sodium here and here, right? Okay, so what happens is that closes. Now what this actually does is it actually reverses the charge on the membrane, right? Now we have a whole bunch more positive inside than outside, okay? And that's actually what causes your muscle to fire. Now to kind of complete that firing, what happens next is this gated protein channel opens up, the potassium gated protein channel, and 2 of these potassium are going to diffuse across the plasma membrane this way, right? Okay, and so then we have these 2 potassium that diffuse over to here. And so at this point, the potassium gated protein channel closes, and essentially we have no charge over the plasma membrane. Now before your muscle can fire again, or before your neuron can fire again, what does it have to do? It has to go through active transport again, right? The sodium potassium pump has to pump. Does that make sense? And so actually, over 99% of all energy in your body actually goes to running the sodium potassium pump in your muscle cells and your neurons. Pretty interesting, huh? Do you know that's where all your energy went to? Now, this happens very, very quickly, faster than what you can see, all right?
So you get muscle cramps and stuff like that, is that because of the efficiency of...
Okay, well, I'll talk about that in just 1 minute. Let me talk a little bit about something else first, okay? So if you think about it, okay, this is happening very, very quickly, all right? Really, really quick. So for example, if you guys can see me moving my finger here. It's not moving extremely fast, but somewhat fast. Before I can contract that muscle like that, all the cells in my finger actually have to go through active transport and set up an electrochemical gradient across the plasma membrane. So this happens in milliseconds, okay, very, very quickly. And the more you move your muscles, the more energy you need, right? Okay, because you need more energy to set up those electrochemical gradients. Okay, any questions about that? Now, back to your question, is this what causes muscle cramping? And the answer is it may be. Okay. Now, there's two different types of muscle cramps that you can get. One is, if you're out of shape like me, okay, and if I were to get all the rest of you that are out of shape and we were to sprint as fast as we could to the AC and back, most of us would probably be dead by the parking lot, right? But by the time you get back, your muscles are really cramped up. That's not caused typically by this. But if you're a well-conditioned athlete, say for example running a marathon and you start to get cramps, then what happens is it's generally because of a lack of this ion right here, potassium. They used to think that it was a lack of sodium, and that's why you might have heard, this is actually before my time even, they used to give athletes salt pills. You ever heard of that before? And because they knew that it had something to do with the sodium potassium pump, they thought, well, they're running out of sodium, so we'll give them more sodium. And what science has found is that it's actually potassium. So like when you drink, if you look at your Gatorade bottle or something, it has a lot of potassium in it. Also, you'll see a lot of extreme athletes or long distance athletes, like in the Tour de France or whatever, you always see them eating bananas. You've seen that? Bananas have tons and tons of potassium in them. So that's why you eat those. Okay. So yes, it can cause cramps, but not all cramps are caused by this. Okay. Any questions about active transport? So active transport actually takes energy to move a substance against its concentration gradient across the plasma membrane. Okay. Any questions?
The definition of it again? Active transport is the...
It's when we use energy to move a substance against its concentration gradient. Okay. The last type of movement across the plasma membrane is what we call endocytosis or exocytosis. Endo means inside, exo means outside. Okay. Cytosis means basically eating. So this is when, kind of like when the cell engulfs something, or exocytosis would be, a good term would be, the cell spits something out. Now, not all cells can consume substances through endocytosis. Not all substances can expel substances through exocytosis, but some cells can. Okay. A more specific term for endocytosis that you might hear is something that's called phagocytosis. I don't know if any of you have ever heard that term before. But basically what happens here is the cell is made up of a plasma membrane. And so that cell, if there's a food particle, or an LDL in this case, it actually comes up against the plasma membrane of the cell, and the plasma membrane of the cell can just surround that particle and then engulf it. And exocytosis is essentially the opposite of that. Okay. Now, a lot of our cells in our body do take substances in through phagocytosis or endocytosis and expel substances through exocytosis. A really good example of a cell in our body that engulfs things phagocytotically is your white blood cells, some of your white blood cells. If you get a bacteria in your body or a virus, you have this immune system. Now, there's lots of ways that your immune system can function. It's really quite complicated. But one way is some of your white blood cells are actually able to surround that particle, that foreign particle in your body, and take it inside of the cell, and they try and digest it inside of the cell so that it doesn't harm your whole body. Okay? So if you have a cold like I do today, then your white blood cell count typically goes up, right? And actually those phagocytic white blood cells work best at higher temperatures, and so I haven't taken my temperature today, but I probably have a little bit of a fever, right? So they can work better. Any questions about that? Okay, any questions about how substances move across plasma membranes? So we have diffusion, osmosis, active transport, and then endo and exocytosis. Okay. This is just showing a paramecium surrounding a food particle and engulfing the food particle. Okay. Any questions about the cell and how basically it functions? Okay, the next topic we want to talk a little bit about then, and I just want to introduce this topic, is tissues. If you remember when we first, the first or second day, I showed you a picture of how what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about atoms, elements, molecules, the cell, and then tissues was kind of the next layer up. And I'm just going to introduce tissues right now, and then we're actually going to go back and talk about some more functions that occur in the cell. Mainly how energy is converted, okay? But there are basically four types of animal tissues. There's what we call epithelial, connective, nervous, and muscle tissue. Epithelial tissue is tissue that lines the body. So, for example, your skin is epithelial tissue, okay? The linings of your mouth and your anus are epithelial tissue. And Uranus, not the planet, the anus, okay? Right. So the linings of the anus, the linings of your digestive tract actually have some epithelial tissue. So anything that touches the outside world is made up of epithelial tissue, essentially, in your body. Nervous tissue is tissue that can conduct an electrical impulse. So basically that's what makes nervous tissue different. That's like your brain, your spinal cord, the neurons that run out to your fingers, okay? Those are, that type of tissue can conduct an electrical impulse. Muscle tissue is very similar to nervous tissue. Muscle tissue conducts electrical impulses and contracts. So not only do they conduct electrical impulses, but they also contract or get smaller. Any questions about that? Okay, the last, go ahead.
You're gonna say it.
Go ahead.
No, I was actually just wondering what connective was, but you can...
Yeah, the last type of tissue, connective tissue, is kind of everything else, for lack of a better definition. The word indicates that it is tissue that connects, so something like your bone or your tendons would be considered to be connective tissue. But also a type of tissue that's considered to be connective tissue in your body is blood. Blood is connective tissue. Okay. So it's kind of everything else, I guess you could say. Any questions about animal tissues? Now with plants, there are also four different types of tissues that we find in plants. We have epidermal, vascular, ground, and meristematic tissue. Plants are actually quite a bit different from animals, but they have some tissues that are somewhat similar. Epidermal tissues are tissues that line the body of the plant. So it's very similar to epithelial tissue. So any part of the plant that you might touch, those would be epidermal cells. Okay. Now, vascular cells are cells that conduct water or nutrients. Now, if you think about a tree, most of you have seen a tree cut down before, right? It has these rings, and then it actually has kind of a spongy layer here, and then outside it has bark. All of you have seen a tree cut in half, right? Okay. This tissue here that makes up these rings is actually vascular tissue. If you look more closely, there are little cells here. Okay. And these cells in the center part of the tree move water from the roots to the top of the tree. Okay, so it's vascular tissue. This little bit of spongy layer that surrounds the trunk of a tree is also vascular tissue, and it moves substances from the leaves to the roots. Roots need to be able to grow, and the only way that they can get energy is from the leaves, and the leaves photosynthesizing. And so the leaves send the energy down the outside of the trunk. Okay. Any questions about that? Then the bark would be epidermal tissue. Yeah.
So what would be a basic definition of vascular tissue?
Vascular tissue is tissue that moves substances within the plant. Now let me give you another example of a vascular tissue. All of you have seen veins and leaves, right? Before? If you see a leaf, you see the veins coming off the leaf. Well, if we were to take a cross section of that leaf, okay, what we mean by a cross section is if you cut it right here and then look at the part you just cut, So for example, if I were to take a cross section of my hand, I'd cut it in half, and then we'd look at the part that we just cut. Okay, that's a cross section. If you look at a cross section through a leaf, what you see is you see epidermal tissue, or the tissue that lines the leaf, both top and bottom. Okay, so here's the epidermal tissue. What you might see is tissue that's kind of circular in nature, and what this represents is where we've cut through a vein, so that's vascular tissue. Okay, any questions about that? Now, everything in between epidermal and vascular tissue, by definition, is what we call ground tissue. So in addition, in this leaf cross section, we might have cells that look something like this here, might have some spongy cells down here, okay? All of the other cells or tissue that's in between the epidermis and the ground tissue, or excuse me, the epidermis and the vascular tissue, is what we call ground tissue, okay? Any questions? Now, the last type of plant tissue, meristematic tissue, is something that we don't find in animals. And really what meristematic tissue is it's where the plant actually grows. Okay, where does it grow? Now, in animals, when we grow, kind of the whole organism grows at the same time, right? Or at least, hopefully, that's what happens. But in plants, there are only certain parts of the plant that actually grow. For example, if we were to draw a Christmas tree there, not a very good Christmas tree. Okay, something like that. Where's that plant going to grow? It's actually going to grow up here, right? Out at the ends of each branch. Okay, it's actually going to be growing around the edges of the trunk, and then it's also going to grow at the tips of the roots. So anywhere where cell division occurs in plants, that is what we call meristematic tissue. Okay. So an easy definition of meristematic tissue is it's tissue that actually is growing in the plant. Right? So for example, if we look at this cross-section of a trunk of a tree, the inner rings, they don't grow. Once they've become established, they don't grow and divide and become bigger, okay, and become more cells.
Right? What was the definition of ground?
Ground tissue is the tissue in between epidermal and vascular tissue. Any questions about tissues? All right, now we want to kind of take a step back and talk a little bit about how cells get energy, okay? And how energy is transferred and works in cells. Before we do that, or first of all, I want to talk about the two major ways that energy can be moved within a cell. The first is through a process that we call photosynthesis. So photosynthesis is the conversion of sunlight energy to chemical bonds. Okay? So a very easy definition of photosynthesis is the conversion of sunlight energy into chemical bonds. Right? So basically, when you think of photosynthesis, most of you think of plants, right? There are other organisms that can photosynthesize besides plants, but basically plants take sunlight. They convert that sunlight energy into chemical bonds that can be used, right? Okay. Respiration is the other major energy processing pathway. And a basic definition of respiration is the breaking of chemical bonds in food to produce useful energy. Okay. And that's what we as animals do. We take food in, we break that food down, and we convert it into useful energy, namely ATP. That's the energy type of energy that we use for our bodies. So really, in photosynthesis and respiration, they are both energy processing pathways. Okay. So what's happening in photosynthesis and respiration is we're converting energy from one form to another. So if you want to think of it this way, use this analogy, whether you're a plant or an animal, you're going to go through these energy processing pathways that are very similar in a lot of ways to a coal-fired power plant. Okay? In a coal-fired power plant, what happens? We convert the energy that's in coal to electrical energy, right? So we're just changing the form of energy. Does that make sense to everybody? So in photosynthesis, we're changing sunlight energy, that form of energy, into chemical bonds. In respiration, we're taking chemical bonds and we're converting it into another form of energy, namely ATP.
Okay. Any questions about that?
Some definitions here. Autotroph. Auto means self. Troph means food. Autotrophs are organisms that do not require food molecules from other organisms. Typically, these are photosynthetic organisms. We'll talk about some exceptions to that. But if you think about a plant, we consider plants to be autotrophs. They don't have to eat other organisms in order to get energy. Okay, they photosynthesize. So most often when we talk about autotrophs, autotrophs are typically photosynthetic. There are a few exceptions to that rule, but typically they're photosynthetic. Okay. Heterotrophs, on the other hand, are organisms that cannot make their own energy and require food from other organisms. So for example, we are heterotrophs. Okay, we are heterotrophs. So hetero means other, troph means food. By the way, you'll see the prefix heterotroph and homo quite a bit in biology. Hetero means other and homo means the same. And all of you knew that, right? Okay. If you think about it, you knew it. Okay. If you think of heterosexuals, what are they like? People of the other sex, right? Okay. Homosexuals like people of the what? Same sex. So you already knew what hetero and homo meant. Okay. Any questions? Now, before we can talk about how energy is processed, we need to talk about a little bit of physics. One of the great things about biology is we use physics, math, statistics, chemistry. Kind of need to understand a little bit of everything in order to understand living things. So, some laws of physics. Let's talk about the laws of thermodynamics. The first law is that energy cannot be created or destroyed. So you just can't snap your fingers and have energy created. It's impossible. Okay. And the second law of thermodynamics is the one that we're really concerned with here. It states that in any change of energy from one form to another, some useful energy is converted into useless heat energy. Okay. In other words, another way of saying it is energy conversion does not take place efficiently or perfectly, I guess you could say. Now, some of you learned the second law of thermodynamics in high school physics or biology. The teacher might have used the term entropy. Any of you remember that? Entropy is going from more organized to less organized. Same basic principle. Okay. So what this is saying is that, let's say for example, in a coal-fired power plant, if you burn coal and let's say there's 100 units of energy in that coal, you will only be able to get maybe 50 units of energy out in the form of electrical energy. The rest of it is going to be given off as heat energy. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So anytime energy conversion occurs, some of it's going to be lost as heat. Okay. Any questions? All of you, yeah, go ahead.
It wouldn't really be converted into heat, but like, would this be the same as using a lot of little extension cords instead of one long one? Like it's.
Actually, that's a little bit different principle, but it's actually it is the same principle. But you're not really converting energy.
Yeah.
Per se.
Like it everywhere that connects.
Yeah, you lose some energy.
Yeah.
A better example might be your fridge. Okay, what you're doing is you're converting electrical energy into coolant energy, right? And as the motor on your fridge runs, if you've ever felt the back of your fridge, is it cold or hot?
Hot.
Really hot. Why? Yeah, actually, what's happening is you're taking electrical energy, you're converting it into coolant energy, and in the process, some of it, or a lot of it actually, is lost as what? Heat energy, because it's converting energy. Same thing is true with your car. Have you ever felt your car hood after you've started your car? It's what? It's hot. Why is it hot? You're converting gasoline energy into motion energy, right? Okay. And so anytime you convert energy, some of it is lost as heat.
Okay. Never converts perfectly. In fact, when you read, for example, on your fridge and it says it's 96% efficient or whatever, high efficiency fridges, believe it or not, that's actually a lie. Okay. The government has lied to you. When they do efficiency standards, they actually double the true efficiency. So if you have a fridge that's 90% efficient, really what it is it's truly 45% efficient. Now why they double the efficiency standards, I guess it's just to make us feel good about ourselves. But
if you have something that's like 55% efficiency,
then that really means, if you see something with 55% rating, that actually means it's half of 55, so it's 26 and a half. Is that right? 27 and a half. Yeah. So, in other words, it's not very efficient. Most of the energy is lost in the energy conversion. Anytime you convert energy, you lose some energy. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. Now there are two major types of energy, or two major terms that we use for energy. One is what we call potential energy, and the other is kinetic energy. Potential energy is energy that is, you can kind of think of it in this way, it's energy that's stored, energy that has the potential to do work. Kinetic energy, on the other hand, is the energy of work. Okay, the energy that's given off or used during work. All right. So let me give you a couple of examples. This is showing a wind-up toy. If a person uses kinetic energy, they can actually wind the wind-up toy, right? And that if you don't let the wind-up toy go, then that energy is stored in the form of potential energy. When you let the wind-up toy go, the potential energy is released and is given off in the form of kinetic energy, and the wind-up toy walks around. Okay. Easier example. Does this meter stick here have any potential energy?
Yeah.
It does, because I just lifted it up. So if I let it go, that potential energy is converted into kinetic energy. And if I have my finger under there, that kinetic energy can be released into my finger and actually hurt my finger. Okay. Now that's probably not going to happen with something that's light, but principle applies. Okay. Maybe even a better example, one of my favorite examples. One of my favorite things to do in the world is to roll rocks. If you guys have never rolled rocks, you just never lived. It is fun. So up on the mountain, we have these big hills, and there are the rocks up at the top of the hill. Okay. And does that rock have potential energy?
Yeah.
It does. If you get a really big rock, like that big, bunch of people push it and push off the hill, that potential energy is converted into what? Kinetic energy. And if you roll down the hill, if there's a tree here at the bottom, this is what's really cool. Is when they hit the tree, that kinetic energy is transferred into the tree, and what happens to the tree? It explodes, right? Then you have the rock down here at the bottom of the hill. Does that rock at that point have any potential energy? Actually, if it's at the very bottom of the hill, it has no potential energy. Okay.
About the rock, if it rolls into it, is that what that?
No, it still wouldn't have any potential energy. So, but I could make it have potential energy. I could do what? I could push it back up the hill, okay, using kinetic energy. I told you I'm a great artist. I love my art. If I use kinetic energy to push it up the hill, then it has what? Potential energy again. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions about potential and kinetic energy? So, when we talk about chemical reactions, really we're talking about potential and kinetic energy. And there are two major types of chemical reactions that we can find. One is what we call an exergonic reaction. The other is what we call an endergonic reaction. Okay. In an exergonic reaction, molecules go from high potential energy to low potential energy, or another way of saying it is they go from high potential energy and give off a lot of kinetic energy. In endergonic reactions, molecules go from low potential energy to high potential energy. Endergonic reactions, then, are chemical reactions where energy is stored. Exergonic reactions are reactions where energy is given off. Okay? So in this picture here, the coconut this chimpanzee has up here has a potential energy because it's in the air. He drops it, that potential energy is converted into kinetic energy, which causes this other chimpanzee, which has no potential energy, to be flipped up in the air and have high potential energy. Okay, so energy is being stored in the endergonic reaction. If we look at this graphically, we can, if the y-axis here represents useful energy or potential energy, and let's call it potential energy, notice that in exergonic reaction, we go from high potential energy here, energy is given off, kinetic energy is given off, and we end up with low potential energy. Okay? So for example, if you were to digest a candy bar, okay, that would be an exergonic reaction, right? Okay, you're taking the energy in the candy bar and actually breaking the candy bar down and harvesting the energy. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, an endergonic reaction is when we actually store potential energy. So, for example, in photosynthesis, when we take sunlight energy and we convert it into stable chemical bonds, that would be an endergonic reaction. We're storing energy. Okay? Or if I take this magic marker, okay, an endergonic reaction would be to lift that marker up like that. Okay, I've stored potential energy now as it's sitting straight up on the desk. Does that make sense to everybody? Now the term endergonic and exergonic, even though I used an example of the marker, typically refer to chemical reactions. All right? Any questions about that? Now you'll notice that in all of these chemical reactions there are these little bumps. Okay. In other words, if we, in order to store a certain amount of energy, this much potential energy, we actually need to input more energy than what we can store. Why is that? Yeah, some of it's lost as what? Heat. Okay. And so this little bump is what we call the activation energy. In an exergonic reaction, chemical reactions just don't happen by themselves. They actually need to what? Need to have a push to get them to go. And that's what we call the activation energy. And that's what that little bump represents right here. Okay. So for example, using our rock example, this rock's been sitting up there at the top of the hill for maybe thousands of years. Right? Okay. What do I need to do in order to get it to roll? I have to what? I have to input some energy before I can get energy out of the process. Does that make sense to everybody? So that's what activation energy is. So if you think about it, in any chemical reaction, the net energy gained is not the amount of, out of an exergonic reaction, is not the amount of energy that's stored. Okay? So this is the gross amount of energy that's stored is the distance between here and here. Everybody understand that? That's how much energy is stored there. However, the net amount of energy you get out of this chemical reaction is the energy from here to here minus the energy from here to here. Okay? All of you understand gross and net, I hope, by now. Right? Gross is what you think you're going to get on your paycheck. Net is what it actually is when they send it to you with all the deductions. Okay, that's your net pay. Okay. It's kind of like this. In order to make, another analogy would be, in order to make a dollar in an investment, you have to what? First invest a dollar. Okay. So kind of the idea between gross and net, if you invested a dollar and you got $2 back, which would be a really good investment, right? Okay. How much net money would you actually get? $1, right? Okay. You take the total minus the amount you've invested into it. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
So is there energy in wind?
There is energy in wind. Actually quite a bit of energy. So this activation energy, if some way we could lower the activation energy, and make this hill not so steep, then we would get more net energy out of a chemical reaction. Does that make sense? In other words, if you could lower the amount of activation energy in a chemical reaction, you would get more net energy out of the chemical reaction. So the question is, how do we lower this activation energy in both exergonic and endergonic reactions? Because endergonic reactions have this activation energy right here. And the answer is by using something that we call enzymes. Kind of alluded to these molecules before. Enzymes are proteins. Okay? Enzymes are proteins. And remember we talked about the main thing that cells make are what? The main product is a protein. Most of the proteins that are produced, believe it or not, are actually enzymes. And what enzymes do is they lower the activation energy of chemical reactions. And for every chemical reaction, it requires a different enzyme to lower that activation energy. Now, enzymes can be used more than once, but they are specific for certain chemical reactions. Okay? So, basically what they're doing is they're lowering the activation energy. All right. Now let me give you an example of something, or an analogy of something that would be similar to an enzyme. Let's say in my rock rolling example, this is a huge rock, as big as this desk. Okay. Am I going to be able to push it? No. If I know Sean, because he grew up in here in Ephraim. If Sean and I push it, are we going to be able to move that? I mean, Sean's pretty buff, get all of that, right? Not really, but. I thought I'd give you the benefit of the doubt, Deshaun. If we both push it, are we going to be able to move it?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe, but probably not, even if we pushed all day, right? But what if we took some big crowbars, really long crowbars, stuck it under the edge of the rock, and then leaned on the edge of the crowbars, what would happen? We could probably move it, both of us together, right? Okay. So what are we doing? We're actually using those levers as what? A way to lower the activation energy to roll the rock. Does that make sense to everybody? And so that's basically what an enzyme is. Enzymes are tools that are used to lower the activation energy of a chemical reaction, and thereby allowing a chemical reaction to have more net energy output. Okay. So in this graph here, in this exergonic reaction, this lower activation energy represents what happens with an enzyme present. Any questions about that? Okay. Any questions about enzymes or energy in general? Now, as we said, the main energy molecule that is used in living things is ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. Now, just a quick review, because the test is coming up in a couple of weeks here. Okay, not next week, but the following week, I believe. What class of molecule is ATP out of our four groups of molecules? It's nucleic acid, okay? And nucleic acids, what are their functional groups? There are three things. Phosphate. What else? A sugar and a nitrogenous base, remember? Okay, phosphate, sugar, and a base. So here we have the phosphate groups. The sugar, this little orange bar represents oxygen, so oxygen in a ring structure, okay? And the nitrogenous base, a ring structure with nitrogen at corners instead of oxygen, okay? So it is nucleic acid, all right? Now, in adenosine triphosphate, we have not just one phosphate group, but how many?
Three
phosphate groups, so one, two, three. Now, the high energy bonds in an ATP molecule are actually between the phosphate molecules. So there are two high energy bonds in ATP. Okay? There are two high energy bonds in ATP. So what happens is through the process of hydrolysis, we can actually break apart an ATP molecule. So if we take ATP plus a water, because remember we need water for hydrolysis, right? And there's going to be enzymes as well present. We can get something called ADP plus a phosphate group, which we're going to represent by PI, plus energy. Okay. So in other words,
if we have an ATP molecule, we break this bond right here, okay, what we're going to end up with is ADP, or adenosine, what do you think that stands for?
Diphosphate,
okay, because there's two phosphates, plus a phosphate group, plus there's going to be energy that's released here. Does that make sense? Now, if we break this bond here, then what are we going to end up with? You can say ADP plus water gives you AMP, which stands for what? Adenosine monophosphate plus a phosphate group plus some energy. Okay. Generally, in most cells, we break ATP down into ADP, and then we convert ADP back to ATP. Okay, does that make sense? In other words, it cycles between ADP and ATP. Generally, the molecule isn't broken down into AMP, but it can be. All right. Now, how much energy do we find in these between these phosphate bonds? In other words, how much energy do we get out of this chemical reaction? And the answer is it's something that we call 7 kilocalories of energy. Okay. 7 kilocalories of energy, or 7,000 calories. Okay. Now, the calorie is a measure of energy. How much energy is a calorie? Does anybody know from your physics class?
Isn't it to raise 1 gram of water 1 degree or something?
Yeah, exactly. A calorie. Small c equals the amount of energy it takes to raise 1 gram of water 1 degree C. Okay? So the amount of energy that's found in one of those chemical bonds is enough energy to raise 7,000 grams of water 1 degree C. Any questions about that? Where else have you heard the term calorie used? In food, right? You count your calories, okay, how many calories are in your food. And actually, nutritionists don't use the same definition as physicists, okay? What a calorie in nutrition is, that's a calorie with a big C. Notice I tried to write a cursive C, so you could tell it was a lowercase C here. Equals 1 kilocalorie. So when you talk about calories that you're eating, you're talking about really about kilocalories. Does that make sense? So if you eat 200 calories today for lunch, really what you're eating is you're eating 200,000. So the amount of energy it would take to raise 200,000 grams of water 1 degree C. Does that make sense to everybody?
So 1 kilocalorie is 10 calories?
1 kilocalorie is 1,000 calories. Kilo means 1,000. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so that's how we measure energy. Now, as I mentioned, in most cells, what happens is we take ATP and we convert it into ADP, harvest 7 kilocalories of energy. And then what the cell does is it takes that ADP and converts it into ATP using energy from the food that you eat, right? We use this energy to turn the sodium-potassium pump. Then what do? We recharge our energy base with the energy that we get from the food we eat, right? Okay. How much energy does it take to get ADP converted into ATP? Okay, you're right. The answer is more than 7 kilocalories. Why is it more? Some of it's lost as heat, plus we also have the activation energy, right? Okay, so it takes a lot more energy. So anytime you convert energy, it's a losing situation. You're going to lose something. Okay. So now let me ask you another question. When we convert ATP into ADP, is that an exergonic or an endergonic reaction? Okay, it's actually an exergonic because we're going from what? High potential energy to lower potential energy, right? We go from ADP to ATP, that is in a what? Endergonic reaction, because we're going from low potential energy to a higher potential energy. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay.
let's go ahead and stop there for today. Okay. What I want to do.